Distributed denial of service attacks are pretty easy to launch these days, so the question is, how do you defend your precious infrastructure against DDoS attacks? I mean, there's so much of them and so little of you, and so today, we are going to design and build a DDoS mitigation strategy, and our guests today are Rich Groves and Eric Chow, both of whom have had their fair share of DDoS mitigation scars from the work they have done in this space. So, Rich and Eric, welcome to the Packet Pushers, and Eric, you were recently on the show talking about your Python networking book. Thanks for coming back on the show. Appreciate that. And Rich, you're new to the show. You've never been on Packet Pushers before. And
I think a neat,
yeah, okay. Well, a neat way to introduce yourself. I guess you have some background with Microsoft and the Digital Crimes Unit. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So thanks for having us on, Ethan. It's going to be a fun talk, I think. Previous to A10, which is where I work right now, that I worked at Microsoft, and Eric actually worked with me at Microsoft. One of the efforts that I really sort of pushed along at Microsoft was the sinkholing of botnets, taking weapons from bad guys, essentially, and that's what we did at the Microsoft Digital Crimes Unit. And it just so happens that that's what we try to continue to do now, Eric and I, except protecting them instead of stealing the weapons.
Okay, so the idea is if there's a botnet out there, you would go and disrupt the command and control network and either get control of the botnet or just make it that it was no longer a viable platform to launch an attack from?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's really what the Digital Crimes Unit is sort of all about, except they take the stance of, at Microsoft, it's kind of easy to get lawyers involved, right, to say, these people have violated our EULA in some way, and so we can go and actually use the power of lawyers to go and steal, forcibly take, there you go, machines away from criminal infrastructure. So,
thank you for having us on the show. It was a very pleasant experience. I'm glad to be back and talk about something that we do on a daily basis. And to me, the work that Rich and I have contributed to at Microsoft is where everything started for this line of work that we're involved in. So, it's very interesting how I can't really imagine anybody but Microsoft to do this, because they have the dollar, they have the team of lawyers, and then they have the kind of the posture to make it happen, as far as, because a lot of these command and control center are in outside of the United States. So it does require a lot of collaboration with, other foreign entities in order to sort through these legal battles that, to seize these servers. So that's kind of interesting.
Well, that's cool. That's a side note that I didn't know about, that there was a such thing as the Microsoft Digital Crimes Unit. So, well, all right, let's move the conversation ahead, because although I'm going to go and research that on the side now, this show is all about DDoS and coming up with a DDoS mitigation strategy. So let's do some level setting. And Rich, I'll direct this one to you. DDoS attacks, they make the news a lot, but are they really common? I mean, or maybe how common are DDoS attacks these days?
What we do see are trends based on verticals, actually. So trends of these big public clouds are constantly mitigating attacks to some degree for their customers, but oftentimes for their own infrastructure, because it's all software defined, right? And then financials are pretty much consistently under attack, but it's sort of a different type of attack. So, we have volumetric attacks, of course, but then there are the sort of these low and slow attacks, and then combinations of the two, right? So people can not only disrupt what you're doing, but steal your money at the same time. Hmm. And those are pretty frequent. The fact is that even now, it's very simple to just get on one of these DDoS as a service, IP booters, IP stressors, whatever you want to call them, and just launch one.
Is it reasonable to say that you're not going to be a victim of a DDoS attack unless you're a target where someone really wants to not just disrupt your service, but maybe also steal something from you, as you mentioned?
I think on the service side of things, if you're actually selling something, this is definitely the case. But I have to tell you, I see even now a whole bunch of DDoSes that are sporadic against Minecraft servers, against other types of gaming environments. as well. So even just to get the upper hand, you know, on someone that you're playing a real time game with, or get the upper hand on somebody that you're you know, you're playing Minecraft, I guess, with. I have to tell you, I'm kind of old and don't totally get the Minecraft thing, even though I did play with Legos as a kid. So, but I think what ends up happening is people build up these really awesome worlds on Minecraft, and then others want to steal them. I think. I don't know. Don't quote. Well, of course, you're going to quote me on that.
You're making a point that, I mean, anybody potentially is a DDoS target if you've got anything interesting. Some companies more sensitive than others. And at the heart of this, what I'm really wanting to understand is, should every enterprise out there be concerned about DDoS and have a mitigation strategy, or is it reasonable to say that if you've got basic security, you're fine, don't worry so much about DDoS, you're just, you know, worrying yourself over nothing?
No, I think it's important to have a strategy for every enterprise, simply because it costs money. You know, it costs money. Certainly, it costs money to come up with the strategy and implement the strategy, but it costs more money potentially to get DDoSed. Oftentimes, people get ransomed with threat of DDoS. Even so, you know, this is big money that people are extorting from others.
All right. Fair enough then. So generally speaking, the vast majority of the people that are listening to this show, there's a case to be made that you should have a DDoS mitigation strategy. Very good. Why is it hard to defend against DDoS attacks?
It's pretty clear to me from looking at a bunch of DDoS attacks over my tenure here at A10 and at Microsoft that many of them are spoofed. Right. So you have a bunch of traffic coming in from spoofed IP addresses all over the place. And it's not easy to defend yourself from these spoofed attacks, because either you're blocking them upstream at a provider based on some layer 4, you know, kind of signature of the attack, or you have to weed through what is a spoofed source, what isn't a spoofed source. And it's more challenging than it might seem.
And if you're on the tail end of that attack, you're the victim, reverse path forwarding probably isn't going to help you, because a spoofed address, there's probably only going to be one or two places it could have come from, and most of them might be legit.
Yeah, that's true.
So you really need ISPs in the middle that would be getting rid of that spoof traffic before it ever hits you. You're kind of helpless if it actually makes it to you.
Yeah, that's right. And at least I think I'm getting jaded as I get older and see more of these DDoS attacks. I've always been very hopeful that ISPs will help the end customer, but in many cases that's just not true.
I think also so of course, you know, the DDoS is nothing new, but the distributed part is where it makes it really difficult for you to, you know, signal out the bad from the good guys. So it's very hard to differentiate the legitimate requests and versus the spoof IPs that you talked about. But I think one thing I want to point out is that nowadays I think ISP like providers who have enough attack surface that they could spread them out. So it doesn't really need to be a internet service provider in the traditional sense. It could be cloud provider. It could be large enterprises. I mean, if you think about the Facebooks and the like the Twitters of the world today, or, you know, even somebody like Yahoo or whoever, who's a big eyeball but not providing internet services, their network is just as big as the ISPs. And so I think if we differentiate those guys versus the guys who are just getting like a T3 or, you know, like a 1 gig pipe to go to the internet versus the guys who are able to have multiple exchange points, peers, public, private, and then in multiple pops of the world, then those guys are able to take on the mitigation more effectively.
That's true. And, you know, going back to that earlier part of your question, Ethan, I think that nowadays, with all of these open IoT devices, surprisingly a lot of them, and all susceptible in one way or another to either, you know, default usernames and password, or ancient code that gets exploited, right?
I've got some thermostats in my house right now that have been bothering me. It's like, I bet I can hack into these things with nothing because the developer hasn't put any work into these things at all. They just sit here and run, and I've had them for years. I'm sure, other than them phoning home to check in with the cloud every now and again, which is how you control them, I bet they're highly vulnerable to something or other. They scare me that they're there.
Oh, yeah. No, this is definitely the case. But the unfortunate bit for the enterprise trying to defend themselves, right, from them is that all of them have a valid stack and don't really need to spoof traffic to be effective, right? So you've got both problems, right, of devices that have a valid stack that are Linux machines, basically, right, that are getting attacks launched from them. And so it becomes even more complicated and furthermore, they're coming from these eyeball networks, right, that Eric's talking about, that you're trying to make money from.
A lot of the people that listen to the show are in the enterprise space. They're mid-market, maybe they're large enterprise. And if they are under a DDoS attack, how would they recognize that? And what's that DDoS attack look like if you're that sort of a end network being victimized?
Sure. So there are a couple of different types. Actually, there are a whole bunch of different types of DDoS attacks. But I think in general, most certainly heightened packets per second is what you end up seeing. But going a little bit deeper than that, lots and lots of connections per second and from at least connection attempts on hosts, if there are a bunch of spoofs, right? New sources that they've never seen before, a high number of unique sources, oftentimes with a DDoS, a spoof DDoS at that, each one of the IP addresses might actually send you one packet, right? But they're just a lot of sources that are sending you that one packet over and over and over again.
So if it's a one packet, would that be a SYN packet typically, you know, that the old trying to saturate the TCP stack kind of attack or?
Well, they're less common nowadays, just straight SYN attacks. I think if you take a look at the reports that are coming out from VeriSign and other cloud providers, DDoS cloud providers, a lot of what they end up seeing is still UDP floods. Mm. And in many cases, I like to use it's NetLab 360, which is a nice community site, and I can send you the link to that if you like. They show that amplification attacks make up for over 50% of the overall traffic, and that sort of manifests to the end user as a UDP flood.
Amplification attack. I know NTP, DNS have been used there. The idea being the attacker sends a spoofed packet to some service. The spoofed packet pretends to be coming from the victim, and then the victim ends up getting back a whole lot of network packets in response.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So DNS, NTP, SSDP is actually a very large one at the moment. Hmm. that we're seeing. And you know, clearly because of the types of packets, you know, SSDP, for example, they're coming from residential customers.
Yeah, so Ethan, I think it's important to differentiate, because we're all geeks here, so it's important to differentiate between redirection and amplification. So if you think about, if you're a attacker, right, like what do you really want? Is that you want a small request, but a huge amount of response, right? So what you describe as far as, you know, spoofing the source to be your victim, send a small request, that's redirection. But because of the amplification effect, it's one small request, like you mentioned NTP, right? So if in the case of an NTP monolith, where you send a small request and they just dump all the monoliths out, which results in multiple large packets, that's your amplification. So the redirection combined with amplification is what makes those so lethal. And same thing with DNS redirection or, you know, any request and so on and so forth. Reflection is, as Rich just pointed out, but you know, that I think you know what I mean.
Right. Okay. Yes. Yeah. A little inside baseball, listeners. We got a Slack channel that are going as we're recording this. So right, Rich pops up. Reflection, not redirection. So yes, reflection attacks.
They should
have hit me in the head. Okay. So I was attempting to be subtle, guys.
I was attempting to be subtle.
No, man. It all happens in the open here, baby.
Oh, okay, that's fine.
So we're talking about the kind of attacks and the things that you might see if you're an enterprise. Now, a lot of enterprises, maybe they're hosting services on their own premises, so they've got some kind of an internet edge. That would be one point of attack. But then they might be co-locating services. They might have services in public cloud. Do the attacks vary against an enterprise depending on where they are hosting their services?
You know, it really depends on whether the attacker is just trying to have essentially a packet generator, like an amplifier, right? Or they've done some due diligence, right? And in some cases, what I've seen is that enterprises give away too much information, right? They even for example, in the text of a book that Eric and I are working on, I describe just trace routing to my bank. So I live here in Honolulu, so it's a local bank. But what you end up seeing is they do things like they give reverse DNS names for their links from router, you know, their routed links, basically.
So you do a trace route, reverse DNS pops up, and then you can infer information from the host name that's given during the reverse DNS lookup?
Yeah. Like they'll do things like tell you that it's a Juniper router and that it's a 10 gig link.
Helpful. Thank you.
Right. Yeah. And then the attacker will go off and do things like generate that same traffic, generate that same, you know, reconnaissance traffic, basically, from multiple source IPs to make sure they understand the hashing, right? To see if it is indeed just one 10 gig link or it's multiple 10 gig links. Mm. And then they have a good idea of not just how much traffic that they want to send, but they also have the IP addresses of some 10 gig links that they could certainly attack. And you may not actually see the traffic at your service itself. You just might see, you know, nothing at that point because the link is down.
Yeah, right. You've effectively been dropped off the map because something in between you and, you know, the rest of the world just got clobbered.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then just keep in mind that the vendors are not bulletproof, right? As you know, some of the guests that on your show might agree to, it's that, you know, if we know it's a Juniper router and there's a vulnerability that comes out that, you know, that's related to Juniper, then, you know, that's a step up that they have there.
Just curious. Now, we've been talking about enterprise since that is what most of the people listening to the show, that's the kind of network that they've got. Now, does a DDoS attack look different if I'm a service provider?
Well, it does. It does look a little bit different. You know, we have, as we've seen from attackers, they all have pretty common tools, like even Mirai. That it's recently, the guys, actually the authors have been convicted, I think. I just saw in the news, which is kind of cool. But even Mirai has many different iterations based on the endpoints that they're trying to attack nowadays because they gave away the code, right? So it was on GitHub. And at first, the toolkit had a bunch of very common attacks, you know, including SYN attacks and UDP and, oddly enough, GRE encapsulation. But now even these new botnets are including exploits. Like, for example, the one for Deutsche Telekom that was highly publicized, so I don't feel weird talking about it. But the attacker figured out what the common Deutsche Telekom home router actually was and then used an exploit on those to gain control of them, right? And then utilize that Mirai attack toolkit, right? So in many cases, you know, we'll end up seeing just a lot of attacks at port 80 or port 443. You might at the service provider or at the service level, you may end up seeing a bunch of SSL renegotiations then end up happening for online stores that we've seen, right? So people attempt to, really successful DDoS attackers try to tailor the attack to the endpoint itself.
Yeah, so I think for service provider, the target is more clear. It's harder, but it's more valuable to attack them. So I think what we end up seeing, and I'm kind of lumping in the service provider with cloud provider as well, is that they end up experiencing a lot of the multi-vector attacks. So it's not just one type of attacks. And it's, you know, maybe the floods as well as some of the more specific tailored attacks that toward that particular provider that they found more information about. So I think it's harder, but the value is higher, and therefore the attacker spend more time on it, as well as more sophisticated attack that's targeting the service providers.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think that for ISPs, they generally have to worry about infrastructure protection, right?
Exactly. So
they have to worry about, you know, high packets per second attacks that are going to bring down their, you know, their line cards and their routers or their interfaces on their routers. And then as you've seen with the attack on Dyn, right, you end up getting this water torture, this DNS authoritative attack, basically, because they knew they tailored the attack directly to the heart of Dyn's business.
Oh, sorry, before I forget, I think it's important to mention a IETF work group. That's an acronym as DOTS, the DDoS Open Threat Signaling Work Group, that precisely is trying to have inter-service provider signaling for DDoS. So essentially, you know, if you pass the service provider boundaries, that you could still continue to mitigate a certain kind of DDoS attack. So it's still in its early days, I would say, and it's gone through a few changes along the way, but it's an important effort that I wanted to mention here, as long as we're on the subject of service providers.
Well, that's an interesting one. We'll have to look that up. We've done some keeping up with the IETF at Packet Pushers this year. We attended a couple of IETF gatherings, and so DOTS might be a good one for us to follow up with and see how that's going. DDoS Open Threat Signaling, just to get everyone to agree on some kind of comms between them as ISPs on something like that would be quite a feat. So I am actually interested to see where that goes. Okay, I want to move us from this foundational level setting part of the conversation into the design aspect for DDoS mitigation. We should now, all listening, have a better understanding of what DDoS is, the kind of ways that it can present itself, and the impact that it might have to your network or to your services that you provide to your customers. How then do you get through it? So I want to get some like cheap and easy things out of the way, some obvious things that you can do without like buying an appliance or in, you know, subscribing to a service, just kind of what I think of as easy enough things, and get your comments on them. So I'll just list four quick ones: filtering bogons, TCP handshake proxying, multiple DNS providers, and then maybe using Anycast or some kind of a dispersal technique so the attack is not so focused on a single point. I mean, are those common sense things everybody should be doing? Are these old school things that don't apply anymore? Do you guys have comments?
Well, I think that filtering bogons is pretty much a given, right? Even if only to reduce the number of IP addresses that are being spoofed toward you, right? You end up seeing really bizarre IP addresses and spoofed attacks, even like zero dot addresses. So filtering bogons is extremely important, also because some criminal organizations like to hijack, you know, some of those address ranges that are in the bogons, launch their attacks, and then withdraw, right? And then they're just gone.
Those lists are maintained in a constant state. If something is on the bogon list, you can trust that it should not be appearing on the public internet. So that's a safe thing to do, and you're not going to get any false positives or anything there.
Yeah, that's right. And Team Cummery stays on top of that.
So
and they distribute the data. You can get it through a couple of different means, including actually maintaining a BGP peering with them. And then they just announce them toward you.
Now, I mentioned TCP handshake proxying, but we've also said in the show that TCP send attacks are less common than they used to be. So is that as big a deal as it used to be to proxy handshakes?
It's still important. I say they're less common, but they're still common. It's just that amplification has sort of taken over that in part. As you can see from like the NetLab 360 report, you know, with things like IoT devices, you can successfully proxy a TCP handshake, right? Hmm. Because it's a real device. Mm-hmm. And handshake proxying, you know, unlike maybe some of the mitigation types that are built into Linux, like, you know, turning on SYN cookies, it just does it sort of automatically. Handshake proxying takes some effort to figure out in your network. I mean, there are tools that you can utilize in IP tables to make that happen, but they definitely have some performance degradation.
We talked about, I mentioned multiple DNS providers. You talked about the Dyn attack earlier. So if you had all your DNS eggs in the Dyn basket, you were hosting your domains on Dyn and that was it, you were effectively offline because people could not resolve your domain name. And so the thought is, well, don't just use Dyn, use Dyn plus, you know, however many other DNS providers. That seems to be common sense at this point for folks, yes?
Yeah, totally sound. Like Bender from Futurama would say, you're completely boned. You know, if you don't do it this way.
Right. Yeah. Right? Okay.
So.
Yeah. And then Anycast, maybe a little harder for some folks to execute, but Anycast, or maybe you want to comment on some other kind of technique where you're able to disperse the attacks, that it's hitting multiple points rather than everything focused on one point and taking you offline in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Anycast is definitely a part of that. It depends on whether or not, you know, it's even important for the service to understand IP addresses. Like, you know, there are some really awesome new features and functionality. For example, in AWS, right? If you're building an API gateway, I know it's not entirely an enterprise use case, right? But it's just a demonstration of the fact that IP addresses are becoming a lot less important when you're operating things like serverless infrastructure.
Yeah, for sure. And it's funny. I'm an old school network guy where IP addresses were the end all and the be all. But you're absolutely right. So many things now are moving to it. It's based on a tag, or as you mentioned, serverless. You're doing a function call. IPv6 addresses are highly ephemeral. Containers in infrastructure are ephemeral in and of themselves. And how you address them in a minute, they're not even going to be there. So if you're launching an attack, you're going to be using something other than IP addresses to launch against, meaning you have to defend in a different way as well.
Yeah, that's true. And there are definitely many scale-out techniques, right, that can be used. In many cases, you sort of have to buy them from a vendor. But utilizing some SDN techniques of your own, or utilizing some APIs that you can use in the cloud, there's no reason why you can't scale out any number of, like you said, containers or virtual machines and sort of disperse the traffic amongst all of them. And I mean, I think, and from a design perspective, it's really important to understand what service you're offering. So, like, if we're protecting a service, I think it's extremely valid, right, to take a look and say, who are my customers, right? Are my customers only domestic customers? Because I don't, let's say, ship internationally, or I don't take. I have no service that operates, let's say, in country A. The question is, why take traffic from country A, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, another point could be that. So, I think part of that is to understand your own infrastructure and understand your own service. Like you said, like what Rich mentioned, is to understand the service that you're offering. So, if you're if your service that you're providing is an interactive gaming, then how many of your customers are actually coming from the cloud, right? Like, how many people are launching EC2 instances to play your game? So in the same token, that perhaps because your unique situation, you're able to filter out all of the inbound AWS public IPs, for example, especially when you're under stress, under attack, that you want to, you know, filter out some of the IPs even before it gets to your pipe using FlowSpec or whatnot. So, I think understanding your infrastructure, understanding your service, coupled with common sense, is always, you know, like step zero, and then before you even going down the line of TCP handshake proxying and so on.
Right. That's really key, because it's also key not just in this very specific DDoS mitigation topic that we're talking about, but in any sort of design, network design or application design, understanding how it works at a deep level is key to knowing what sort of redundancy and resiliency is going to benefit you versus not, and so on. Such a big deal. So yeah, your point is very well made, Eric, that is a key thing. Well, all right, let's we talked about some like high level things here that you can do that aren't even specific mitigation techniques necessarily, more or less along the lines of best practices and some common sense things. Moving now to, I'm trying to design for this specific issue of mitigating a DDoS attack. What are my major design elements? So just to give you some of my background and some of the things I'm familiar with, I'm thinking about things like having lots of bandwidth to help deal with an inbound flood, although maybe that's kind of impossible these days to have enough. Then mitigation appliances you can have that maybe help you, or subscribing to a scrubbing service that can upstream from you send you the good traffic and filter off the denial-based traffic. What are your thoughts here, gentlemen?
I think you've outlined it pretty well. Just to very quickly add something to the last part of the discussion, which is, you know, of course, knowing your service, but then even being able to filter out, and I find this really interesting. I find this really important, and therefore that's why I'm bringing it up. A lot of traffic that we've seen in DDoS attacks and other types of attacks are sourced from countries that just happen to be on the U.S. trade embargo list.
Surprise!
Yeah. So it's actually really easy to look that up on the State Department's website. I know I'm U.S. I'm very U.S. minded, U.S. focused. Not everyone that listens is going to be, but it's good to take a look at the State Department website and see which countries are actually on the embargo list and filter accordingly.
But here's a very practical question then about filtering those lists. If you're sitting at the edge, what good is it doing me sitting at the edge to be filtering those off? Because if I'm seeing the packets, they're already hitting me. Where does the advantage in dropping them come? I'm thinking out loud now. I guess if the issue is not just filling the pipe, but is attacking a service, is that where the benefit comes in?
Yeah, that's really the benefit there. But in some cases, you know, you can aggregate, for example, those embargoed countries. You can then aggregate, do some due diligence to figure out which ASNs are being announced by providers that are in those countries. And because, you know, we're network people here, right? It's much easier for me to drop based on some BGP extended attribute rather than just, you know, maintaining some gigantic list of IP addresses. And so there's no reason why I can't take that and make sure that my ISP just doesn't send me that traffic.
Right? ISP doesn't send it, or I get it and I drop it?
Both. You know, it really depends on what you want out of your service. I think both are definitely valid. Sometimes, you know, it's important to make sure that you reduce your spoofed attack surface, and those are sort of low-hanging fruit to do that, along with bogons, from our experience. But also, you know, if traffic is coming in because it's volumetric attack or something like that, you just don't want them touching your service. You know, in some cases, we see these high connections but low rate attacks that end up happening from these embargoed countries as well. Now, I'm not saying it's a complete filtering strategy by any means, but really, you know, if we frame up the conversation around what can you do if you don't have, you know, tons of money and you're going out and you're buying these DDoS mitigation platforms, both cloud and, you know, the actual device itself, then these are some things you can do and you'll be reasonably effective.
Is there a lot of point in having a gigantic pipe just in case you get a DDoS attack coming inbound, or is that pointless now because it doesn't really matter how big the pipe is, it's going to get overwhelmed?
Yeah, that's a real problem. So, I mean, I think if you can, much like these really large providers, big public cloud providers, if you're sort of ubiquitously peered, deeply peered in the internet and have big pipes, that helps. If you have one, you know, a primary and a backup peer, and you have big pipes to each one of those, then it's not the right strategy.
Okay, you mentioned mitigation appliances there. First, help us understand, first of all, what does a mitigation appliance actually do?
Well, they do a bunch of things, right? From looking at inbound traffic, being able to, it depends on how you have it deployed, right? You can have a detection strategy where you're sending NetFlow or S-Flow from your infrastructure, or even SNMP, you know, to monitor rates off to some detection software or even device that tracks bandwidth, but it also tracks unique sources. It tracks source port groupings, dest port groupings, and then you know, number of connections per second, total number of connections, and then gives you some understanding of the potential DDoS.
It's doing an analysis of all the traffic it's seeing. Again, it sits off to the side. It's being sent flow data, or you know, pulling SNMP. Somehow, it's getting metadata about what's going on the network. It categorizes it all, and then based on how the software is coded, it's finding the patterns and going, "Yeah, this is probably, you're probably under an attack or not."
That's right.
Sounds like it. Okay, so that
that's a good characterization. You know, also possibly sitting off of a port mirror. So
all right,
for a detection strategy, some people actually just put the DDoS mitigation device in line all the time. But you know, for doing this at scale, that's generally not how it's done.
Now, is a DDoS mitigation appliance meant for like the typical end user enterprise, or is it more meant for a service provider?
Well, it depends on which one you buy. Basically, I mean, there are lower end devices that sort of provide detection and signaling functionality to something upstream, your upstream provider, or some DDoS mitigation service that you might end up paying for.
In other words, it may say, hey, I'm detecting an attack. Here's the information I've got. Can you do something about this? As opposed to it as itself as the device doing something about the attack?
Yeah, that's right. You might have something that cries for help versus does some data plane work.
Got it.
And you might have something that's just a big powerhouse doing nothing but data plane work. Right.
Okay. So then if I'm the end user using that appliance, typically I'm going to be doing a call for help, because the bigger appliances would be what? Tend to be overly pricey?
I think that's part of the strategy. Generally, what we see from the market and deployments of our own devices that we build is that that you end up seeing the smaller, you know, customers doing this sort of hybrid implementation where they detect, and if they detect such a large volume or such a large uptick in volume that something upstream needs to mitigate it, just because they don't have enough bandwidth, they don't have enough capacity, it'll definitely cry for help. But if they have one of these low and slow kind of attacks, like the lots of connections but just sort of holding them open and sending zero windows all the time, or things of that nature, they end up handling them on-prem. And it also depends on whether or not you are concerned with that upstream provider actually looking at your data. And some people are.
Yeah, so I think if you categorize it into both the on-prem and off-prem, so that's kind of a, in my mind at least, you know, that's always how I always separate the two, is on-prem mitigation versus off-prem mitigation, and you could actually do both, right? So you could have a device that's handling some of the mitigation up to a certain point, and knowing that limit is important. And once that it's, you know, under too much stress, or it's on ramping to be more than that it could handle, then could go ahead and signal upstream and you know, mitigate off-prem that way. So I always, in my mind, categorize between on-prem, off-prem, and then a hybrid model.
Yeah, and prem could be like the management domain where it's like your company, right? Or prem could very well be whatever infrastructure you've built for a service, and you're still the transit provider for it, right? Right. And so when I speak of premise, that's sort of how I think about it too.
All right, I want to relate this to IDS IPS technology in this context. So I think we still have IDS because IPS has struggled with false positives and legitimate traffic being dropped that the business has determined to be too risky. And so the mode seems to be more IDS and then react as issues come up. Is that also a thought with DDoS where there's false positives, where you're dropping legitimate traffic to such a degree that it's too far, gone the other way, trying to keep the service up?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in some cases, it's hard to differentiate. You can spend money to get out of this problem in some cases, right? But doing it yourself, in many cases, it's hard to figure out what is a flash crowd versus what is a DDoS attack. You may have done something right,
right.
and you're still getting blitzed by a bunch of eyeballs, but it's actually valid and they're trying to get your product or buy your service or something like that.
Right. It's not you've denied yourself service because you're so awesome, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. And we see it a lot, right? So
yeah.
The story is really about availability more than some sort of like security filtering. I mean, that's part of it, but understanding the traffic, understanding your service and your sort of business cycles too. Right. Some people get blitzed whenever they send out a patch for their software, for example. you see that a lot in video games, actually.
Let's talk about scrubbing services then. So if trying to do it myself and running my own DDoS mitigation appliance deployed in whatever mode, either the cry for help mode or deal with it myself mode or both, should I just forego that maybe and utilize a scrubbing service instead that I subscribe to? And I ask that having some history with this and knowing they are, oh my gosh, incredibly pricey to subscribe to these services, especially once you press the button and say, help, I'm under attack, and they start scrubbing things for you.
Yeah. And you took the words right out of my mouth. I've done research on this part, and man, oh man, are they pricey. And if you really dig in and see what it is that they're offering, in some cases, it's just a massive flow spec service, right? Where they may not have true sort of deep packet inspection kinds of DDoS mitigation. But somebody might say, oh, I've got, two terabits of capacity, but it just so happens that it's 2 terabits that they've somehow calculated a flow spec capacity through lots of peerings and lots of Juniper routers, right? But you really have to take a look and see what it is they're actually mitigating. And what I've figured out from that and doing that research is that they're not mitigating everything that you would actually need them to mitigate, right?
Now, just a quick word here for folks that have heard the word flow spec come up on this show several times and are unsure of what that is. That we're talking about BGP flow spec, which is using BGP as a mechanism to, correct me if I'm wrong here, guys, but share between routers an access list of hosts that should be filtered, and flow spec is the way to do that. And if we go to Priority Queue Show 78 in the Packet Pushers Library, we published a show on that in detail back in May 2016, if you want to hear more about flow spec.
Did you just come out on this, remember that number on the spot, Ethan, or you remember every single show?
I used Google quickly. Because I know I did not remember that on the spot.
That's pretty impressive, I was going to say.
I know, I was bowled over, actually.
BGP FlowSpec, we covered in some detail how it works and what that is. But right, so FlowSpec as in the scrubbing service you're subscribing to is really just using BGP FlowSpec and a router that's got the capability to have huge JCLs populated that they can use to clear up the bad traffic and then send you the good traffic. And you've probably got a tunnel over to the scrubbing service that they're going to use to send along the remaining good traffic. And there's routing that happens there where you your traffic, your IP blocks that you were announcing to the internet, they're going to announce them for you. And then effectively use that tunnel to send the good traffic to you through that back door. That's roughly the way I've understand the services to work.
Absolutely, and that and I forgot to mention this before, and it's actually really important to consider having an upstream provider that will allow you to inject a flow spec route yourself upstream, right? Because when you're talking about DDoS amplification, sometimes you can put together a really concise layer 4 signature. It kind of depends on how much collateral damage you're okay with, right? With flow spec, so one could drop for DNS amplification, for example, one could drop all source port 53 traffic coming into your network. Right.
Yeah. So perhaps it's worth pointing out, Rich, that FlowSpec is pretty flexible, and in some cases more flexible than a traditional ACL. Not only do they match the traditional 5 tuples, they also match TCP flags, and the action could be more dynamic. Like besides just dropping, you could also rate limit it. So
yeah, it's true.
So it's a lot more flexible, and if you were if you're paying an arm and a leg for something on the along the lines of the same thing you would get for just this service, then why not? So I think that's essentially where we're getting at here. It's just that if they're just doing flow spec, why not just use flow spec yourself? Do a little bit of homework, do a little bit of due diligence, and just be in more control of your own destiny.
But in that scenario, though, Eric, you still need an appliance that can do the analysis, come up with the flow spec records, and then deliver them in the right format to the provider that can add that to their flow spec implementation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was kind of tie into what we talked about as far as, the ASNs that you would, maybe just on a certain list that you don't even need to subscribe to. And you just, use the upstream service. And you're absolutely right. Like the flow spec, your device still needs to support that feature. But that's a trade-off between, paying somebody or paying yourself and still have some value at the end.
Well, I guess that kind of asks the question then. I mean, if I'm a designer evaluating these services, does the rise of BGP flow spec and flow spec availability, because I don't have a good sense of how broadly service providers are supporting flow spec. I mean, but does that kind of mean that's my first choice? And if I can't get flow spec to go between me and my service provider, that I would then spend the big bucks and go with a scrubbing service?
I wouldn't exactly equate the two, right? So with flow spec, in many cases, you talked about using it reactively, right? But if I am attempting to insert, let's say, utilizing FlowSpec, if I'm attempting to insert a rule that says I'm going to drop all this source port 53 traffic, it also turns out that I'm dropping any off-net, DNS responses, right? Those can be reactive. If you're utilizing FlowSpec, or because that otherwise that's really challenging, right? To get correct without a lot of collateral damage. But some of these attack techniques, like SSDP, for example, being able to announce a FlowSpec route upstream to block all inbound SSDP traffic, which has a very clear layer 4 signature to announce upstream, will block the SSDP traffic coming into your network. And who the heck really needs SSDP traffic coming inbound? I don't know.
Yeah.
So that one, things like that can sit in place all the time.
In other words, there are certain preemptive things you can do that are safe and common sense, just based on like SSDP. You expect to see that on a LAN helping you to discover a service. You don't expect to see that on the broader internet being advertised to you inbound. And so therefore, doesn't it make sense just to filter all those off?
Yeah, that's right. And if you have an upstream provider that's willing to do that for you, like to be able to go through the list and say, gosh, I don't need SSDP charging. Who the hell uses that except for when they're trying to, you know, blitz my service, of which there is there are plenty of charging attacks. If I don't need to terminate a GRE session, do I really need to take the GRE traffic? Probably not.
But again, asking your provider to filter those for you, as opposed to you on maybe your ingress edge router having this extensive access list that filters off a whole bunch of stuff, you know, in that ACL and drops it and then only allows, well, yes, I have an HTTPS service. I should be allowing 443 through the door. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we've talked about a lot of design elements here, and we covered a lot of ground going from some basics and foundational common sense things we should be doing. We talked about mitigation appliances, the different styles and roles that those play. We talked about scrubbing services, the expense of them, and what they do or not. One point I need to follow up on the scrubbing services, Rich, you made the point that FlowSpec and scrubbing services are not equal, and they shouldn't be thought of as like this is an either or, and they do roughly the same thing. How is a scrubbing service different from FlowSpec, which is effectively an interesting way to populate an ACL upstream?
You know, we've talked a little bit about FlowSpec already. FlowSpec's pretty indiscriminate. You know, if I'm attempting to mitigate an attack, and my action that I'm taking with this FlowSpec primitive that you've announced is to rate limit, then of course you're going to rate limit the good and the bad traffic, right? And so there's a fair amount of collateral damage that you might actually cause. Much like, you know, people, they like to one very common method for people, and I'll get back to the FlowSpec thing in just a second, but This is related. One common method that people use is inserting a remote trigger, you know, black hole route, right? So if you have one IP address that's getting blitzed by a DDoS attack, one method to take care of that problem is to drop that IP address that's getting attacked upstream.
Now, something, you know, it gets into your BGPAS, you've got a /32 internally that you're black holing, you know, at the edge, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's right. Now, of course, the attacker wins, right? Because you've effectively brought down that IP address, but you're managing collateral damage with a function like that. So, but with a DDoS service, it's not so indiscriminate, right? So the idea is I am filtering out things that I can do with a packet level signature that switch chips and routers are actually capable of. I do that with the FlowSpec announcement. And then I start becoming a little bit more surgical, you know, with the DDoS mitigation system itself. So there are definitely some, there's definitely a flow of, let's say, anomalous traffic that comes in, you know, anomalous flags altogether. But that's still, we could still sort of take care of that in an ACL and maintain that. But the DDoS service will give you a way, for example, to sort spoofed traffic from not spoofed traffic. Basically, we're getting into, at that point, the functions of the mitigation devices that they buy.
So assuming the scrubbing service is more than just a glorified flow spec you can take advantage of, the scrubbing service then can have more intelligence as it does its flow analysis and decide what's good and what's bad, and be it's got more savvy about it. So there's a better chance you're going to lessen collateral damage then.
Yeah, and in my mind, it's all about, you know, reducing the collateral damage at that point and making sure that you're still able to make money off of the service. So sorting through those spoofs, making sure on a per source basis at that point. So in theory, you know, you're sorting out the spoof traffic. Now you're maintaining some understanding of the amount of traffic that is being allowed per source IP, and making sure that's not sort of overrunning you. And then being able to do things like challenges at the application layer. Like, for example, with HTTP, someone may actually pass the TCP, in essence, the TCP challenge, which would, and when you're sorting out spoof traffic, like, you know, I may send, when I see a SYN, I may send a reset and wait for that same source to send me a SYN again, right? Whereas with HTTP, in theory, that's already happened and that source has already passed that. So I may want to send them a 302 and see how the browser actually works. I may want to...
You're up at that level, at the HTTP level, and sending a 302, you can kind of infer from, okay, if I send them a 302, what kind of a response do I get back? And then determine, this is some kind of a not very smart bot that is emulating a real client, or this really is a real client and I can let it through.
Inserting JavaScript, for example, or inserting a cookie through a JavaScript, let's say, and then looking for that cookie again. And the same goes for some DNS methods as well. So there are lots of different, you know, methods that can be used with the DDoS mitigation platform, whether it's on-prem or running in the cloud, versus just utilizing FlowSpec for such a thing.
Yeah, so I think also it's safe to say that just like other cloud providers, that they're aggregating the demands, right? So the reason they're more sophisticated because they're able to spend more time on it, more research, and maybe it's the first time you've seen this attack, and you know, there's a fair amount of learning curve associated with it, but it might be the fifth time that your scrubbing service have seen it, and they're just a better response time, better tribal knowledge, so on.
So the takeaway for a designer then is, if they are looking at spending the big bucks on a scrubbing service, they need to really quiz the service about how their service actually works and what value they're providing. Are you just a fancy flow spec box, or a big flow spec box? Or are you actually doing intelligent layer 7 discovery that's going to limit collateral damage and keep the vast majority of my legitimate customers coming to me during the DDoS attack?
That's a great summary of it. Yep.
Mm.
Yeah, mm. Yeah, for sure. And then even in that scenario, we've found that it's important to still have some level of DDoS mitigation on premise, right? Because these services, even though they're really big and they're really pricey, they're still, for lack of a better term, leaky. Right.
Oh, in other words, where some amount of bad traffic gets through the door too.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, okay, then. We've been talking about the design phase here. This is a design and build show, so let's talk about build as a way to conclude the show then. If you're saying I should still have a mitigation, DDoS mitigation appliance on my network, even if I'm employing a scrubbing service, where would I position that? How do I put that into my network so that is the most effective?
Well, ideally, it would be as close to the edge as possible. Right. It sort of depends on what attacks you're really concerned about. Like, for example, some attacks, to mitigate them, you have to be in line because you may want to actually see the return path.
Explain that. I just missed that a little. Okay. Keep going with that. You want to see the return path because you're trying to understand the attack.
Yeah, that's right. Like, for example, I may be able to mitigate a DNS attack of some kind, right? Let's just say, pulling this one out of the air. But it would be even better if I understood the amount of NX domains that are actually coming from the service outbound, to know, whether or not you're just sending me a load of queries that have and records that don't actually exist, or domains that don't actually exist. So being a little more surgical actually in that scenario sort of requires in many cases an inline device.
But again, typically, we are positioning the appliance as close to the edge, or maybe another way to put it, as close to the attacker as possible.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the most effective. And in general, whenever we work with customers, and what we've done personally, when we're actually users, is that we want to be deployed as close to the edge as possible, so you're not melting the rest of the infrastructure. And then, in depending on the scale with which you're trying to operate at, you know, whether you're a big customer or a small enterprise or something like that, you may want to be reactively in line versus proactively in line.
So, Rich, you might want to differentiate, you know, so reactive is probably widely understood, but inline reactive versus, you know, passively.
So, you know, some people, some vendors out there and some network designers really want to have the device inline taking traffic all the time. For one reason is that the devices are generally... they give you good visibility, actually, into your service, gives you good visibility into the traffic on your network in many cases. And so there's value over and above mitigating a DDoS for having a DDoS mitigation device actually seeing your traffic, right? And so that's one thing, kind of like a middle box that's always taking traffic.
Mm-hmm.
But in the reactive model, in general, people will do the NetFlow, S-Flow thing that we talked about earlier, and then insert a route to suck traffic toward the mitigator whenever for the service that's under attack, right? Basically, so that they can make the most use of the mitigation capacity of the device. Because sometimes it's hard, right? It's hard to get traffic to move in one direction or another, and you're trying to scale. So this
is interesting. I mean, I'm thinking about the NFV model that so many middle boxes have followed these days, and yet it's kind of difficult to put a DDoS mitigation appliance into that NFV model where you'd, or is it? Maybe that's a question. I mean, is there a model where rather than, we've been talking about the appliance, you know, the DDoS mitigation appliance, and I'm kind of imagining this box you bolt in and so on. Is there a model where you have a bunch of little virtual DDoS mitigation appliances that you kind of scatter across your network to spread the load out of detection and mitigation?
Yeah. I mean, I think a couple of the vendors are selling virtual appliances. We definitely at A10 Networks, we actually sell one.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to note that in the NFV environment, not only are utilizing some, you know, high-end hosts that allow us to do that allow for DPDK kind of level packet processing is pretty important. Therefore, the virtual machines scale much better. But also, being able to take, you know, one of the takeaways I hope that we can have for this particular podcast is understanding that DDoS mitigation is a sort of an infrastructure-wide job, right?
Yeah, well, I think this is really important because that's something that we need to establish here. I think a lot of people are maybe imagining this DDoS appliance that sits kind of near their internet edge and plugs in there, and that's about it. And if things get through the door, well, they got through the door. As opposed to, you know, another... And this is key in my mind because we've said, okay, ideally the DDoS mitigation appliance would be as close to the attacker as possible, you know, as close to your edge as possible. But if we're going to spread the load out, if we're going to, you know, make it a wider deployment, by definition, then it ends up being closer in on your network, a little further in from that internet edge, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And really just utilizing each component for what they're good at. You know, switch chips are good at dropping traffic.
Mm.
as we know. Right?
They have no problem dropping packets. Okay.
Oh, no, they're really good at that. and so, you know, if dropping or some sort of rough rate shaping is something that you want to do, doing it with a switch chip is totally the right way to go. If you need to have something that is really sort of dedicated to understanding sending out these challenges to understand spoof traffic and some application layer things, then utilizing a lot of fast general purpose processors is definitely good for that, and tons of memory.
Hey, right. Ethan, I want to go back to the point you made about one ginormous box. I just want to also point out that it's pretty flexible nowadays. It's true that you want to sit it to the edge as possible, but you could also distribute the load amongst, you know, using traditional tools like ECMPs that you spray across multiple different devices. So it doesn't have to be one bottleneck, right? Like you want to have high HAs, you want to have just these redundancy built into place just from a traditional routing perspective and spraying of traffic perspective. And also you're able to, so Rich mentioned about, you know, seeing the return traffic, if you want to analyze it, that is all good and true, but you also have the choice of having an asymmetric routing that's, you know, you take the dirty traffic, you scrub it, you pass it back, and then you never see the traffic again. And that actually scales out better as well. So I think there's a certain amount of flexibility that's built in, and you could have, you know, multiple tiers and so on, just because it's flexible enough to speak routing protocols and integrates into your fabric.
Hey, I'm glad you put it that way. I have a massive phobia about the ginormous box. I want a scale-out architecture no matter where. Because even if you're small and you don't need a lot of capacity today, you might. So in my mind, I love to design things where even if I'm starting small today, I want to know tomorrow I can just replicate it and make it, you know, X2, X3, X4, however big I need to go over time, and not have to re-architect the whole thing because I went all in on a single appliance and now I got to go a lot bigger, and it's a big pain in the butt to redesign the thing. So hearing about, you know, the NFV and the scale out and the ECMP and all these different flavors that I can use is that makes me happy.
And I mean, that's super important if you go into the virtualization route too, right? I mean, it's true that it could spin up VMs all over, but at the same time, those VMs is probably just a fraction of the capacity as opposed to a hardware box. So if you have a way to load balance and so on just through traditional, you know, methods, then that makes NFV much more feasible rather than not.
Hmm. Okay. A couple more practical build-related questions. Thinking about my appliances, my mitigation appliances themselves, however I've deployed them, physical, virtual, scaled out, etc. Do I have to protect them in some way? Because I mean, they're a critical part of my infrastructure, right? And keeping my infrastructure up and running. So do I? For example, are they getting data feeds where that helps them understand what's good and bad, where I need to be very careful that they can always get their data feeds? You know, this kind of thing. Any special considerations there?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to note that in general, if you are using offline data, like you're sending NetFlow or SFlow, right? Most people deploy with devices that are not going to have to take actual data plane traffic. And so, definitely, you know, you want to do what you can to make sure you can scale out the detection piece as much as possible to protect it from overload. Luckily, NetFlow and SFlow exports are easy to load spread, right? Because they're UDP based. So that definitely is a good point.
Okay. Tell you what, guys, we've been going for about 75 minutes now. We've been talking about DDoS mitigation, and we could keep talking, but let's wrap it here for the day by sharing just some places that people could find more decent information. So I did a little Googling around, and I found on Russ White's rule11.tech site a couple of great articles on dispersing a DDoS and scrubbing a DDoS, where he's, in typical Russ fashion, very thoughtful on and philosophical about that. Well worth reading. I mentioned Packet Pusher's Priority Queue Show 78, where we talk about BGP flow spec and denial of service mitigation in that context, give you a good introduction of that technology. Do you guys have recommendations that where you'd like to send some folks to find out more about DOS and DDoS mitigation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to admit, I don't have a specific set that I utilize myself. just because I'm always in the midst of building it, and then and then getting requests from customers, getting an understanding from the field, so that ends up keeping me occupied.
Are you social, like Twitter or LinkedIn, or do you blog where any of your thoughts here maybe come out and people could follow you?
Yeah, sure. So we do have a blog for A10 Networks. I know that Eric has his his blog as well. I have to tell you, I do utilize a couple of different sites now that I think about it. One of them is the NetLab 360 site, which has way more to do with giving you an understanding of maybe what DDoSes might look like, but also DDoS activity and some malware activity. They do a lot of research on that side. So so I tend to look
so
there.
That looks like netlab.360.com?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay,
I
have that's what Google's coughing up, so I was hoping that sounded familiar to you. Got it.
I hope okay. so. Let me make sure here.
Yeah, and just while we're waiting, I also... So we're doing some researches on, you know, obviously that we love to share with the public. So also also fired up a kind of a ugly but functional landing page that people could sign up with their email if they wanted to hear more about, you know, in the future. I promise there's not going to be a lot of spams for sure, yeah. As well as, you know, protect your privacy, you could opt out anytime. But I just wanted the place, like you said, Ethan, to... for people to just keep in touch. If we have something worthwhile that we think that might benefit people, then there's a channel for us to reach them at.
Yep.
So and the link is in the show notes.
The link for that exactly will be in the show notes. So if you go to packetpushers.net, this is going to be, this should be weekly show 379 on design and build DDoS mitigation. If you just find that, you can click through and get more good information coming from Eric and Rich and some of the folks at A10. We've got some other links in here too, Azure's DDoS protection preview, Amazon Shield, and then Eric, of course, they can find you on LinkedIn and so on. And then there is the IETF group that we mentioned before, the DDoS Open Threat Signaling working group, and what that is going on, the DOTS working group, which you
By
can
the way,
find
that, that
up on IETF.org.
And the so, NetLab 360 link is correct.
Okay.
Ethan, by the
great.
Way.
Okay.
And just what you know, one last bit there to keep in mind is that in many cases, people don't like to talk about DDoS attacks that they're seeing.
Right, for corporate sensitivity and so on, that context.
Yeah, the Cloudflare guys love talking about it, and I think in part because it helps sell their service, right? So I don't have a specific Cloudflare link. But pretty often you get to see trends from Cloudflare and some mitigations that they end up doing. So that is in general pretty interesting reading.
Got it. Okay. All right. Well, Eric and Rich, thank you very much for coming on and chatting about DDoS mitigation. We went on, I know when we were prepping for this before we started hit the record button there, I said, you know, 45 minutes. And it's 80 minutes later and we're wrapping up this conversation. I really appreciate your time and chatting about this. A lot of very practical perspective on what to think about. Because I wanted to do this show because it feels like as a practitioner, if you're being a victim of a DDoS attack, you just seem so helpless and frustrating to try to combat. So to get some real world perspective on how to combat it and the kind of things you can do ahead of time to help limit the impact if you're undergoing a DDoS attack, I think was a great conversation to have. And again, I really appreciate your time, both of you. So yeah,
thanks, Ethan.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
Yeah,
thanks, Ethan.
And thanks to you for listening to Packet Pushers today. You're a trooper if you made it all the way to the end of this one. You can find this and many more of our fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog. Community blog meaning people like you writing about the day-to-day life of being in networking and IT. That's all at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and hey, rate us on Apple Podcasts if you would. That is a genuinely helpful thing you can do that'll just take you a few minutes. Last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.